Welcome to the Progressive Beat. I'm John Neuroer, and this week, my co-host Christy Harvey and I talk to Tommaso Baja of Campus Progress and the Energy Action Coalition about how he's working to make clean energy the most important issue for young people and why it isn't a myth young people actually will come out and vote this year. And as the economy is quickly becoming the number one issue in November, we hear from Gene Sperling and Larry Summers about how the economic debate is shaping up. And finally, we listen in on Governor Mike Huckabee appearing at the Center for American Progress to talk about the importance of arts education. So stick around. You're listening to The Progressive Beat.
This is Christy Harvey, and you're listening to The Progressive Beat. And today, we're going to wonk it out a little bit and take you inside the closed doors of an event that was held last Friday at the Centers for American Progress, an event titled Corporate and High Income Tax Cuts and the Economy. And right now, we'll go to Gene Sperling. Now, Gene Sperling was a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, but he's also the former National Economic Advisor to the President under President Clinton and the Director of the National Economic Council. And in this clip, Gene Sperling talks a little bit about the five stages of supply-side grief.
I actually, in terms of the kind of star of the beast, I always thought that just like there was kind of the different stages of dying, the Kubler-Ross identified, there tends to be kind of the different stages of the supply-side argument. The first is kind of defiance, and that's when they argue that it all pays for itself. And then when it kind of looks like it's not, then it's denial. Deficits don't matter. And then the third stage is conversion. And that's when the deficits are way up and they kind of convert and say, yeah, you know what, we were wrong. Deficits do matter, but the only way to deal with it is cutting spending. And so that's kind of actually, I think, the three stages of supply side denial. You know, Jeff kind of came up with snake oil, and I was trying to kind of think of my own name as well because, you know, I think Jeff and Larry and I, you know, we have our own version of supply-side economics. We kind of think if you increase the supply of highly educated Americans and savings and investment in research and infrastructure, that that supply would help increase a more productive job-creating U.S. So I was, you know, kind of looking at different ones potentially. I had written an article recently called Rising Tide Economics, which is to say the test should be that the rising tide does in fact lift all boats. There's might be rising yachts economic, since they're actually kind of saying if you just give money to the people with the yachts, that will actually, I guess, divide the water and lift the water, and supposedly that will also lift boats. But I think when you actually look through the their actual arguments, and having had the privilege I've had many times, but just recently to debate this with Grover Norquist, I'm kind of stuck between Rosemary Wood's economics, and which basically means that you have to contort yourself in really a rather unseemly way to kind of make your case. And then my others is, and this I feel bad about because I was always known, I was always tolerated by the communication guys in the White House for being able to be brief, and I can't, you know, give brief sound bites and stuff, and I can't, I'm kind of stuck on the most selective and convenient causal analysis of all time economics. So, hopefully as I go through, a few of you can work, you know, work with me on trying to narrow this. Now, in terms of, you know, why I'm tempted to the most selective and convenient causal analysis of all time economics, of course, that has to start a little bit with how things developed in 93. I will spare you reading the Chicken Little quotes or the, and not just from politicians, but from very many eminent economists who will be vying for high position, whenever there's a Republican administration, that said that that marginal rates, particularly at the top, were a huge, huge determinant of the economy, and that one could expect essentially job loss and recession. Obviously, I won't go through all the numbers. That isn't quite what happened. So then you start getting not being able to make the case. Looking back, there has developed around capital gains tax cuts. a highly specialized form of Rosemary Wood's most selective and convenient economics of all time analysis. And it really goes to this. Even though the entire 7 years following that showed an uptick in investment, as Ettlinger and Lyons' paper show, 10% investment versus 2.7 during the two periods after supply-side tax cuts, even though all of those things, it is true that 1998, 1999, and 2000 were particularly good years for the stock market. And so the analysis becomes that that is solely because there was a cut in the capital gains rate, which President Clinton agreed to as part of a compromise, from 28% to 20%. Now, of course, at the same time as that happened, one could have also attributed the stock market rise to, you know, a Democratic president being reelected, a Democratic president who was committed to fiscal discipline, a pledge to save surpluses for Social Security. You might have even thought it had something to do with things like the dramatic spread of the internet and information technology affecting, you know, an enormous amount of business practices and inventory management. All of those things you might have thought this was a rich and very multifaceted analysis. But according to the supply-siders, the capital gains tax cut at that point is kind of a superpower causation or a superhero causation. You have to ignore all of those other things, and then you look and you say that was the sole reason for the particularly strong bump up in 98, 99, and 2000. So whew, with this Rosemary Wood's most selective causation, their case is alive. Well, you know, the one thing about democracy, whether we like it or not, is sometimes the other guys win and they get to try it out their way. And so this was an enormous opportunity to now show that it was not Rosemary Wood economics. And so in 2001 and 03, we had an enormous cut in upper income marginal rates, as well as dividends and capital gains rates. So of course, and I think there's some fairness to this, it's probably fair often to not count 2001 all the time. There was a recession. It was when 9/11 happened. So if one looks kind of after the recession and looks how things are going and actually looks at the stock market, which is what they've decided to make their whole case for the superpower effect of capital gains on, then if you look at the end of the recession and after 9/11, adjusted for inflation, the stock market today would be 12,165. So over 7 years, in real terms, the stock market has actually gone down since the start of the Bush upper income tax cuts. In fact, it would be 12,775 in March of 2002. Now, once again, you see that you see the flip. You know, it's really not marginal rates. You would kind of think everybody would be pretty much going along with just restoring the tax cuts to where they were in the 90s, because so much of the argument now, by failure of real-world proof, has had to be around capital gains. So now, again, they see an opening, and a very highly contorted opening, to show their case for capital gains works. And here's how it happens. Everywhere, pretty much in the developed world, around the end of 2002, stock markets went down, not because of really the bursting internet bubble, which had already happened, but almost everywhere because of jittery nerves about the impending invasion of Iraq. And as you remember, and I actually talked about it at places like this, many people did, Stu Eisenstadt had a whole paper on it, the likelihood of oil disruption, a shock, et cetera. And markets went down. And pretty much everywhere in 03, when the worst case scenarios didn't happen, markets went up. So if you ever had a situation where it was fairly clear and you could look at a variety of different markets to show why something happened, it was this period. And the Federal Reserve, of all places, put out a paper pretty much showing that was the case. Nonetheless, the supply side historical case goes that, well, if you look at the lowest point in the fear that in Iraq, ignore the fact that all the other European countries are going down as well. That just happens to be when George Bush started talking about a capital gains tax cut. So the reason it went up in the United States in 2003 from very low levels of around 8,000 in the stock market was not because everybody else was doing it, but because, no, it was the capital gains cut from 20 to 15%. That seems extremely Rosemary Woods economics on its face. But what's interesting is how incredibly unimpressive it is, even if you grant them their best case scenario. So if you were to say, yes, the stock market was at 8,850 in May of 2003, and the improvement afterwards was because of the capital gains and dividend tax cuts. Even if you were to assume that, the rate of the rate of growth in the real growth in the stock market since then is 1.4%. You know, you could have done with a pretty decent competitive checking account, you probably could have done better. Even if you grant them there, if you look actually at when the capital gains tax cut passed, it's been 0.66%. And again, granting them, even if you took this, by October 2003, going forward, the stock market is down in real terms. Now, let me just be very, very clear. I am not making the argument that one should be looking fundamentally at the movement of the stock market. In fact, we had very much a philosophy in the Clinton Foundation that you look at the fundamentals of the economy and not the gyrations of the stock market, as our fearless economic leader used to say, Bob Rubin, markets go up, markets go down. But I am simply trying to say that given their absolute best case scenario, what is the what is the case? So when you look at that, when you look at that level, even in their most ultimate Rosemary Woods economics kind of level, that is an extremely unimpressive case going forward. And then you come to the rising yachts part, which is why are you even making the stock market your judgment? I mean, it's actually kind of audacious for somebody to be trying to argue gaining credit from 2003 onward. This is a period in which average hourly wages since the capital gains tax cut passed are down 36 cents in real terms, in which there are more children in poverty, in which almost any measure we've had very weak job growth for this kind of element of a recovery. And then my final thing is just, I'll just do very quickly then, is kind of, I think, the new face of supply side economics, and that is corporate tax cuts. And the corporate tax cuts, they can't actually use a selective causation, because even with selective causation, there's really nothing to point to in U.S. To support that. In fact, the corporate rate went up from 34 to 35% under President Clinton, and what followed was an investment and productivity and jobs boom. So this is a little bit more in the Rosemary Woods economics. And the way it goes is that, oh, yes, that might be true, but haven't you looked at Europe? They've been cutting corporate rates as they've kind of harmonized there, and thus now everybody is going to pick up and leave. And even though 59% of corporate tax rates will flow to the top 1%. The number one thing we ought to do in our country right now is have a dramatic $150, $200 billion a year cut in corporate taxes. So just to be clear on a few facts, while we do have a high statutory rate on corporate taxes, the effective rate is actually, just we saw from the GAO, about 24%, right in the middle, smack in the middle of the G7. When you look at debt-financed investment, we are actually the second lowest of 20 OECD countries. So we are almost have the most favorable low tax situation possible. And so again, this is just kind of the new face of kind of selective, of Rosemary Woods contorted case to somehow find a way for these high income tax cuts. And I think it just leaves with three final points, which is one, as As was said at the beginning, there is a rate in which things can be too high. But one thing about the 1990s is it provides a real-world comfort level. When you're at a rate that was in the 90s, you have a real-world example that that did not have a deterrent on investment and productivity and job growth and small business creation. Secondly, I think as progressives, that when you are going to do something that by distribution analysis is going to be so regressive, it doesn't mean you should never consider it, but it should have the highest burden of proof. We supported things like the New Markets Tax Credit, Empowerment Zones tax incentives, that would actually, for the people who receive the direct benefits, be more upper-income investors. But those are cases where you therefore hold it to the highest burden that it works or that it is going to flow to disadvantaged and low-income opportunities. What we have here is doing the most regressive things with, as Jeff and their paper shows, the lowest burden of truth. And my final point, and I'll stop, Sarah, is that we as progressives can't never end our analysis there. We have to have our own pro-growth, progressive vision on the supply side, too. And I think, for example, and the kind of universal 401k proposal that I talk about all the time, that Larry and I and Jeff worked on in the USA account proposal, where we show with hard economic evidence that incentives for savings among lower and moderate income people actually increase net savings, therefore being good for our pool for savings for growth, reducing economic inequality, and making clear that we're just not saying no, we're saying there's a better way to increase the supply of savings in a more progressive way that raises the tide and lifts all boats. Thank you.
That was economist Gene Sperling talking about supply-side economics, and the economy is so vital in the upcoming presidential election. Let's just stick with the topic for a little while and stay at the same panel, but this time let's listen to Larry Summers. Larry Summers is the former Secretary of the Treasury and Chief Economist of the World Bank, and in this clip he will talk about the overall revenue impact of decreased tax rates, as well as what would happen in a world where everyone changed their name to Summers.
On the IRS building, the words of Oliver Wendell Holmes, "Taxes are what we pay for civilization," are engraved. And the question of how the nation taxes, to what extent, and how it structures its taxation is one of the most fundamental choices that any country makes. And the study of taxation has long occupied a central place in the study of economics, and it would be folly to suggest that issues of incentives and issues of the impact of taxes on incentives don't occupy an important place in that study and should not occupy an important place in that study. And certainly we as a country have had moments when we have had certain taxes at rates that were probably higher than was prudent. I have no doubt that John Kennedy did the right thing when he supported a set of tax reforms that reduced the top tax rate in the United States from 90% to 70%. I think the overwhelming evidence suggests that the reductions that took place in the late 1970s and early 1980s of top tax rates below 70% to levels of 50% or below were in order. The public policy question is not a religious, do tax rates matter or not? The relevant public policy question is, in the general range where we are operating now, with a set of competing priorities, what, if any, priority should be attached to the putative incentive benefits of further tax reductions for those with high incomes? And that's the question that I want to address in my remarks this morning, and I want to make five observations. First, contrary to a vast amount of what is asserted, it is not clear on the basis of economic logic even what the direction of the effect of tax cuts are. To see this in the simplest way, imagine that in order to meet its mortgage, meet its desire to make a charitable contribution, whatever, a family wishes to earn $100,000 after taxes, because that's what it needs to spend, and it finds itself in the 33% tax bracket. That family will choose a level of effort that will produce an income of $150,000, which after a 33% tax will lead to $100,000 of after-tax income. Now imagine that that tax rate is increased, say to 50% in this example. Then in order to maintain that level of income, the family will have to work that much harder to earn $200,000 in order to meet that $100,000 nut. Surveys where people are simply asked, what would you do if you raise your taxes, are as likely to report that they would raise their work effort in order to maintain their level of consumption as to suggest that the effect goes in the opposite direction. These kinds of effects exist in other areas. Suppose you think that after taxes you can earn 4% on your savings to plan for your retirement. You will choose a certain amount to save. Suppose happy times come and you decide that you can earn 8% on your retirement savings. Then the amount you need to put aside in order to be secure at the time of your retirement will go down. It will not go up. So the idea that raising tax rates necessarily discourages the working hard or necessarily discourages savings is simply not supported by economic logic. One can make the point more broadly. People always talk up when they talk about capital gains, they always talk about people thinking about buying assets. But what about all the people who are holding assets right now? If you cut the capital gains tax, then it's much cheaper to sell the asset on which you already have a gain. So it's as likely that you would set off a wave of selling as that you would set off a wave of buying. So the first thing to say is that contrary to a huge amount of what is asserted, there's nothing in traditional economic theory that suggests that it is necessarily the case that cutting tax rates will provide incentives for more work, more saving, or higher asset valuations. Second thing that I would suggest is that the highest marginal tax rates in America and the marginal tax rates that cause the greatest distortions are almost certainly those on low-income workers associated with the phase-outs of a range of government programs. The fact that if you earn more money, you will lose your Medicaid. The fact that if you earn more money, your food stamp allotment will be reduced. The fact that you're less likely to be eligible for rent subsidies with the passage of time. The highest marginal tax rates are not on those with the highest incomes. To the extent that one feels that marginal tax rates are substantially distortionary, adjustments in these programs to provide for slower phase outs and increases in the earned income tax credit, which reduce marginal tax rates for a much larger group in the population, have a much larger impact on incentives than anything else does. And I would argue that the most important supply-side economic policy that the United States has adopted in the last 20 years was adopted in 1993 with President Clinton's leadership, spurred on by Gene Sperling, when the earned income tax credit was expanded. So my second observation is, to the extent that one decides that marginal tax rates to create disincentives are a central priority, the way to act on that decision is to focus on those with the highest marginal tax rates, who are those who are the working poor. Third observation, tax cuts that are selective can very easily create distortions. I wish the clever little remark I'm about to make was original with me, but it actually was a point that Mike Kinsley first made. He said, imagine that, he didn't say it this way, I'm going to say it this way. He said, imagine that you all of a sudden had a tax cut in which you announced that there were going to be lower taxes at only half the rate for people with the last name of Summers. What would you expect to happen 3 years later? I submit that what would happen is that there would be many more people named Summers in America, and that the tax special tax program for Summers people would be raised. We'd be raising more revenue from people named Summers than we had ever raised before. Of course, the FISC as a whole would be substantially impoverished, because when Gene changed his name to Summers, he wouldn't like the reputational aspects, but he would like the tax cuts, and the government would lose revenue from cutting taxes on Gene, from the taxes at the normal rates on Gene. What does this have to do with anything? The essence of a tax shelter, the essence of a modern tax shelter, is that you take an economic activity, you find a way to borrow money to deduct your interest at the ordinary income tax rate, and then to pay taxes at capital gains rates. So, of course, when you cut capital gains tax rates in a variety of respects, you see more capital gains revenues, just as if you cut taxes for people named Summers, you see more revenue coming from people named Summers. But no one thoughtful would do the analysis of the overall revenue impact in that way, because just as you have to recognize that we're not collecting Sperling taxes anymore, so you have to recognize that a whole set of sheltering activities generate a whole set of additional shelter activities. That's the example with respect to capital gains. When you cut corporate taxes, it's not a neutral thing. Some forms of economic activity are being supported much more than others, so you're getting inefficiency arising from those differences. So no presumption that tax cuts necessarily work in the right direction. If you want to cut them on those who have the highest marginal rates, who have lower incomes. The tax cuts can't be measured just by the universe of the people who receive the tax cuts because of the sectoral distortions that they create. Fourth observation, and if you remember only one thing I say, this is actually the most important thing to remember. Enlarging a budget deficit is an especially distortionary and dangerous form of taxation. Whether you're a supply sider or you're a demand sider or you're a Keynesian or whatever you are, a Democrat or a Republican, we all do have to live within the laws of arithmetic. When the government finances its activities by selling bonds, it does have to pay the interest and the principal on those bonds. Yes, it can issue more bonds, but then it'll ultimately have to pay the interest and the principal on those. That means that a decision today to increase the budget deficit is not an alternative fiscal policy. It is a commitment to tax increases and spending cuts in the future. Now, Jeff and Gene talked about how the available evidence suggests that when you run larger budget deficits, it does not typically lead to lower spending. That I defy you to find any substantial number of people in the actual economy who somehow believe that because their taxes were cut, spending is going to be far lower in the future. That means that the knowledge that we have tax cuts is the knowledge that we are going to have higher taxes in the future. We don't know the form of those taxes. We don't know when they will come. They come with substantial uncertainty. Now, I ask you, which is more likely to distort activity? A tax today that falls primarily on the business you built yesterday, on the income you're earning on the basis of all your past investments, at a rate that you know and understand, or a tax increase that will come at an uncertain time according to an unexpected formula that will fall on the fruits of the decisions and the investments that you make in the future. I don't see how anyone can conclude that a deficit is other than a particularly large and potent tax increase. And so those who propose measures that would enlarge the budget deficit by trillions of dollars are committing the nation to trillions of dollars of particularly damaging and distorting tax increases. Note one other thing. If you raise the money today, you raise the money today. If you commit the nation to the future, $100 borrowed today at current interest rates is $180 a decade from now. And so the tax increase that's going to take place in the future is much larger than the tax cut that is committed today. So fourth argument, deficit-financed current tax cuts are in toto tax increases with all the disincentive effects that attend to tax increases. So far, I've made 4 points of logic calling into question many of the assertions that are made in the political process. I just want to conclude by saying that while empirical evidence is never conclusive, it is highly suggestive in this case. There is a criterion that scientists use, which is that ex post evidence is always much more powerful than ex ante evidence. The idea is that if there's a bunch of data and you make up a theory to fit the data, well, you knew what the data was when you were making up the theory. So if you make up the theory, you make up the theory before you've seen the data, it's that much more powerful. In 1988, motivated by essentially these arguments, but looking fully at the data for the period since the Second World War, I published with Roger Altman an op-ed in the New York Times. It made the point that for all of these reasons, if one looked not at questions of inequality and fairness, where the answer is what you would expect, but if one looked at the rate of GDP growth, if one looked at how large investment was as a share of GDP, if one looked at the growth and profitability of corporations, if one looked at the performance of the stock market, one could do a comparison of periods when we had a Democratic president, a progressive president, and periods when we had a conservative president adopting the more supply-side philosophy. And the data up through 1988 spoke clearly that when we had a progressive president, the performance on all of those indicators are better. Now, you know, maybe we chose the indicators to fit the facts, all of that. We certainly were supporting a candidate at the time. Now, that theory can be subject to test. We've had 20 subsequent years. You all know what's happened. Compare what happened in the 1990s with what happened in the years before. Compare what happened in the 1990s with the 8 years since. There is plenty that we can reasonably argue about that economists disagree about, and they should disagree because the evidence is not clear. But on the proposition that smaller budget deficits are beneficial to the American economy, and on the proposition that fluctuations in tax rates within the range of the high 30s for top individual rates and on the order of half of that for capital gains, that fluctuations in that range do not meaningfully negatively impact on economic activity, logic and evidence are as clear as is the case for any proposition in economics.
And with us now here on the Progressive Beat, Tommaso Baggia, who is a climate change advocacy associate at Campus Progress and Campus Progress Action. And he is also here today to talk about a project that Campus Progress is a part of, the Energy Action Coalition. So, Tommaso, thanks so much for being with us here on the Progressive Beat.
Thank you for having us.
So, Tommaso, tell me a little bit about what the Energy Action Coalition is.
The Energy Action Coalition is probably the most exciting thing that's been happening in the United States in the past couple of years. It's the joining of all the major environmental organizations and an opening up to all kind of small, minor, more local organizations that are all doing great work, organizing communities, organizing young people throughout the nation.
So these different organizations, they're not all necessarily youth-centric organizations like Campus Progress is they are focusing on educating youth and getting them out to vote around these issues of clean energy. Is that right?
So the great thing about it is that it's such a diverse organization. You can imagine how hard it is to coordinate a huge group like the US Bergs that work on everything from college affordability to climate change to toxics with groups that are smaller, more locally focused, like the Environmental Justice Climate Change Coalition. There's always a lot of issues that come up, but also we have a common goals, common purposes, and our common goal is to really unite the youth movements to fight against climate change. And it's been going great. We're on our third year so far. We've been blasting through all of our targets that we set 3 years ago for all everything from policies passed on college campuses to students recruited and students that we've communicated our message with.
Talk to me about some specific things on campuses, for example, that the group, that the coalition is doing to reach these goals that they've set.
Well, the first campaign that the Energy Action Coalition launched was called the Campus Climate Challenge. Actually, as a student, I was part of the Campus Climate Challenge, and the challenge was to make your campus as sustainable as possible. With the election coming along right now, we're trying to move past the campus. We're trying to move into the electoral field and trying to activate young people to vote and to make their voices heard, not only within their communities, but in the, not in their immediate communities, but in the national arena as well. So we launched a new campaign called Power Vote. And the aim of this is to really make climate change the big one, number one issue that young people are voting for. The aim is to get 1 million people to sign on to this really ambitious climate platform that is really the minimum that young people are willing to settle for in terms of climate in terms of climate action. Anything less than this is not going to guarantee us the future that we need and that we deserve and that our parents and our previous generations are not leaving for us.
So talk to me a little bit about the specifics of what someone would be signing on to. Mm-hmm. Now, is it a personal thing? Is it a thing that you are saying within the community we're going to make changes? Or is it sort of a combination of all these things?
It's kind of a big mix. The amazing thing about it is since we are such a diverse coalition that we needed to make it as versatile as possible.
Right.
What the pledge says is, I'm young, I'm going to vote, and that climate change is an issue that I really care about, and I'm willing to make my politician to hold my politicians accountable for. What this leaves room for is for people to just sign it and be like, yeah, I'm going to vote, yeah, I care about this issue, and that's it. And also people that are really going to become leaders in their community to put their information down so that they can be called. This is technically a campaign that was launched right now in early September that's going to last just till November 4th. But that's not the real truth. The real truth is that we're going to be keeping all those contacts that we gained and all the people that said they wanted to do something more about it. We're going to tell them to do something in the first 100 days of the next presidency.
So it really sounds like it's about building a coalition of not just you have this coalition of groups, mm-hmm. but now it's even sort of branching out and building a coalition of people on the ground, of people who can work and organize grassroots on the ground, not just for November 4th, but after that as well.
Yeah, because as you know, like politicians always promise a lot during elections, but it doesn't mean that they're actually going to deliver. And it is up to us to hold them accountable. So they're not going to have an easy time in January through March, because on every college campus in America that the Energy Action Coalition has people in, there's going to be events, there's going to be rallies, there's going to be students calling their representatives every time something comes up to demand climate action now.
Now, I, in conversations that I've had and I've heard about the youth vote for 2008, it's not always true that energy independence, clean energy, is at the top of the list of issues most important to youth voters. The war in Iraq, for example, the economy in general, college affordability, things like that have been issues that have come up often before clean energy independence. So do you think and do you really believe that it's sort of an issue that isn't being talked about enough and that clean energy independence is an issue that really is more important to the youth vote than people are talking about?
Well, there's definitely two parts of that question. The first part is, why are people not talking about it and why are people not interested in this? Through the surveys, it doesn't look like people are interested in it.
Sure.
If you look at the presidential debates, both the Democratic and the Republican ones, there were, I believe, like three or four questions out of hundreds that were about climate change. or that worry about environmental issues in general. When the media never mentions the problem, and when even throughout this this spring and this summer, we've seen record numbers of tornadoes, record numbers of wildfires, hurricanes, all sorts of severe weather events that are deeply connected to climate change. I'm not saying that any individual of them was due to climate change, but right. The recurring pattern of these severe weather events are predicted by science. The media never once makes that connection. Your Hurricane Ike, you see all the devastation in Texas from this massive hurricane. Never once did they mention it. So you can't really expect people to put it high on the list when they never hear about the problem. And the second part of this is that really when you see economy at the top of the list, an economy that is a fossil fuel economy that is failing us, that has been driving up fuel prices, gas prices, that has been making people poorer and with fewer jobs, that is deeply connected to climate change, because the biggest solution to climate change is to inspire and to create a new green energy economy that will bring green jobs in America. They're safer jobs. They're better jobs. They have the potential to lift people out of poverty and to really put our economy in the right place. When you see the second biggest issue, Iraq, this is a war fought for oil to fulfill our dependence on this drug, really, that we're so addicted to we can't even get over our addiction right now when we're hit the hardest. People are waiting in lines 2 or 3 hours to get gas, and most politicians are still not even talking about moving past it. We're talking about drilling for more oil,
right.
Which is just like saying let's find another drug dealer because our drug dealer got killed or something, but it's not really solving the problem.
Right.
So all of these issues are intrinsically tied to climate change, and people care about these issues. It's just the connections are not made, and that's part of the work that we're trying to do with the Energy Action Coalition.
So from a messaging standpoint, do you think that what the next step is to connect climate change, energy independence to those issues that are maybe more obvious to voters, like a poor economy, mm-hmm. Their gas prices, yeah. For example. Green jobs is a term that's been thrown about a lot lately, and it's getting some traction, and it seems like it's because it is, from a messaging standpoint, tying the economy with climate change, energy independence. Is that the way to go?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why when you see our coalition, how it's been working, the emphasis has always been about expanding our boundaries and engaging unlikely allies. For example, right now, unions are one of the targets that we've been working with the most. They're stoked about the idea of green jobs because it gives them another way to really get more power and more political momentum that they haven't been getting recently. It gives them an opportunity to provide their members with better jobs that are right now leaving the United States like crazy. So in these unlikely unions, you're really seeing a lot of really great things. Another example is with faith-based groups. We're seeing a lot of evangelicals that are now turning and seeing climate change as a big fundamental moral issue. And that's why we have an organization called Restoring Eden as part of our coalition that works specifically with not necessarily progressive communities,
right?
Because most of them don't believe that abortion is a sin. They are probably creationists, but climate change, that is a big issue for them because that's us disrespecting creation. So it's really becoming about framing climate change as part of a set of problems rather than as climate change itself, because I don't think people are there yet. They don't see it yet.
Do you think young people understand that frame and that connection better than, middle-aged or older Americans?
I've always been kind of curious about this, because you'd think that someone that has lived more than our generation would notice that the weather is really different from the way it used to be. I mean, you always hear old grandpa saying, oh, when I was a kid, this is how the weather was. Mm. But, people don't really pay attention to them. And I don't think they even make the connection. I think young people recognize that past generations have left us a mess of a nation and a mess of a world. And they're committed to change it and to make it better. And they see environmental issues as an intrinsic part of that. They see the 60s as a very successful moment to pass clean air legislation and clean water legislation. But then they turn around and they see their cities still foggy and hazy. They still see the waters where they can't swim and they can't fish, because fish have been turning up with two heads in some rivers in America. I mean,
right.
that's How can you, especially close to the tar sands that a lot of conservatives want to develop for more domestic oil, which is another crime against humanity?
But, I mean, in times past, the environmentalists were sort of a marginalized group. They were an outlier group. And do you think that the idea of someone who is an environmentalist being somebody outside the mainstream is changing?
I think so. I think it's getting very incorporated in a lot of other things. I saw both as a college activist and as a right now working with college students in my work, that most college students that are progressive, that are politically active, consider themselves environmentalists. Even if they work on Sudan, on the war, on other issues, environmental issues are still really strong with them. It might not be the strongest one, but yeah. And the majority of my generation realizes that we need to have a stronger commitment to the environment. It might not be the number one issue that they're voting for, but I feel like there's a really strong connection between our generation. And
yeah. So wrap things up and touching on something mm-hmm. that you just mentioned, but a more general topic. Do you think that that young people are going to come out and vote in the numbers that many people are projecting with the excitement around the primary election, especially for Senator Obama mm-hmm. and Senator Clinton in the Democratic primary, and the number of new registered voters who are young people? Mm-hmm. Are they going to realize these projections that they're going to come out in mass numbers mm-hmm. and make a huge difference, no matter what the issue may be, whether it's energy and energy independence or Iraq or the economy? Are they really going to come out this year in the numbers that are being projected?
I think this is a really exciting time because there's been, other than the candidates who have been really inspiring in this round, and not only the ones that won, if you look also at the way that Ron Paul and Huckabee managed to turn out huge hordes of young people, or like on the other side, Clinton and Obama, it's really amazing. You see that these politicians are starting to really talk to young people in a way that young people can relate to. Previous elections, you had John Kerry, who is an amazing progressive politician, but at the same time, he can't really young people cannot really relate to him. He's kind of a slow talker,
right.
You know,
right.
For the reason that he lost. So I've been seeing a lot of youth engagement. Also in 2006, a lot of the toughest races in the nation were decided by a margin that was the margin that of increase in youth turnout the election. So I think there's a trend, and our generation is more politically active than previous generations. We just need to have politicians that are talking to us and that really manage to relate to us.
So it sounds like almost a perfect storm of politicians who actually are talking to young people mm-hmm. and then issues that personally are affecting them, which may yeah. get them out to vote this year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tommaso Baja, thank you so much. Climate Change Advocacy Associate for Campus Progress mm-hmm. and Campus Progress Action, and also working with the Energy Action Coalition. Tommaso, before you go, is there a website that people can check out?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, there's a couple for you.
Okay.
First one is definitely powervote.org. You can check out the campaign that's going to move America's youth towards voting for climate change. And then if you check out campusprogress.org/polarbear, you can check out our newest video about climate justice. It's amazing. Really funny video. Basically saying it doesn't take a polar bear to get you to care about climate change. Just look in your own backyard. Just look at children with asthma in your community. And that's all you should care about.
Fantastic. Tommaso, thank you so much for being with us here on the Progressive Beat.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Progressive Beat. I'm John Neuroer. This past week, Governor Mike Huckabee, former Republican presidential candidate and former governor of Arkansas, visited the Center for American Progress with Representative Joe Crowley, a Democrat from New York, to talk about music education and the Music National Service Initiative. After rocking out to a Beatles song, Governor Huckabee discussed why it's important to emphasize arts education whenever we're having a discussion about public education. Let's listen in on a portion of Governor Huckabee's speech.
Music is a universal language, and it transcends so many of the normal divisions that we see in politics. And what the congressman was saying is so incredibly true, that there is a power of diplomacy within music that is untouched and untapped, and something we really should use. Think about it. When we first were talking about opening doors with China back in the Nixon era, It was the arts that originally opened those doors. This past summer, it was the arts that gave us the capacity to wedge into North Korea. And in many cultures where there are just amazing differences, one of the few things that can form bridges happens to be the power of the arts. Now, I'm a passionate believer that we have made a huge mistake in this country, particularly as it relates to education, by somehow pushing the whole issue of music and the arts off to the side as if those issues are extracurricular, extraneous, or expendable. And I like to think of them as rather being essential. And if we want to know why one out of every three kids in this country drop out of school, it is not because students are dumb. It's for the most part because they're incredibly bored. And they're bored because we have failed to understand that there is both a left and a right side of the brain for every student. And if we have an education system that only stimulates the left or the logical side of the brain and we ignore the creative side, we have not educated students. We simply have engaged in data download. We have taken information from the teacher. We have downloaded it into the student. But the real power of an education is not transferring data from one brain to the other, but it's making sure that the data download is equally enhanced by the capacity of the operating system on the right side. Think of your computer. If you had the most magnificent database in the world, but not an operating system, it might as well be a boat anchor because it would be worthless. The power of the computer is in the processor. It's in the power to take the information and do something with it, not the information itself. The vast amount of information without the capacity to know what to do with it is worthless. And one of the reasons that I'm convinced we're seeing not just the dropout rate, but an extraordinary challenge of getting students to master language and math and the subjects that we think are so important is because we have pulled students away from one of the most important parts of their education, and that's the stimulation of the right side of their head, making sure that they were completely educated rather than just informed. Now, I have said many times that if we're really going to change the country, we do need to unleash weapons of mass instruction, which for me means music and the arts. Now, I'll focus primarily on music, but I equally could talk about dance or the visual arts or theater, because whatever it is that touches that part of the talent of a student in the creative is a valuable part of making sure that our education system works for every student. And by the way, you know, I always tell audiences when I get the opportunity that one of the powers of the arts is that we never outgrow it. I mean, there are some things that we experience as school students that are truly adolescent in their capacity. Music and the arts, not like that. At my age, one doesn't play tackle football anymore. But I can still play music and do. In fact, I plan to be playing as long as I live. I mean, look, think about it. Did anyone think that the Rolling Stones would be playing past the age of 65? Keith Richards has been dead for several years. He still plays. It's still amazing to me. I don't know if you could find a pulse on Keith right now. You know, you're like, oh, my gosh. But think about this. Here are people who started when they were teens, and they're still playing, in fact, making some of the best music of their lives. And it doesn't matter whether a person is 7 or 70. There's never a point at which we somehow lose either our ability to play or certainly our ability to appreciate.
That's been the Progressive Beat for this week. Thanks for listening. I'm John Neuroer. For my co-host, Christy Harvey, we hope you'll come back next week and listen to us once again on the Progressive Beat.